This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. In a week where the United States has apparently clarified a policy on whether families of hostages can deal their loved ones out of captivity without getting in trouble, we wonder, does this clarify an apparent contradiction? Families can do what they like, says the administration, but has this longstanding principle changed?
I believe it is high time that the civilized countries of the world made it plain that there is no room worldwide for terrorism. There will be no negotiation with terrorists of any kind.
That was Ronald Reagan speaking as a candidate in a presidential debate against Jimmy Carter back in 1980. That's a principle he took into his administration. From ISIS to Hezbollah to Hamas, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, North Korea, do we grant these groups legitimacy by opening talks with them directly, or do we freeze them out to get them to concede? Jonathan Powell is the former chief of staff to Tony Blair and author of Terrorists at the Table, Why Negotiating is the Only Way to Peace. He joins me now. Jonathan Powell, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Remind us of how, with Prime Minister Tony Blair, you had a serious bit of work cut out for you to make peace in a conflict that appeared to have no end at many points.
Yeah, well, for 10 years, I was the chief negotiator for the British government on Northern Ireland. And at the time, it felt like a Sisyphean task. It was miserable. It was time-consuming. I was supposed to be chief of staff in No. 10 Downing Street at the same time. But in retrospect, it was the most important thing that I've done, and it was something that I'm the proudest of. It actually saved a large number of lives.
How do you know you're talking to the right person in a hostage, not a hostage negotiation, a negotiation of any kind?
It's always difficult because people often turn up and claim to be the representatives of terrorist groups. I work now with a large number of such groups, and you can never be entirely sure. Sometimes you need a sign. You need a tape of a hostage if that's what you're dealing with. In the case of the United States, they used to, in Iraq, ask people to fire missiles in the air so they knew they were actually talking to the right people.
And there's something about knowing that if the person inspires a certain kind of, this is the person who makes me angry, this is the person who has struck at the heart of my nation, then you know you might be close, because often there's speaking through interlocutors that, while it may be more pleasant, isn't necessarily more effective.
It's often very visceral, even for me in a small way. The first time I met two terrorists, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, I refused to shake their hands. They had shot my father in an ambush through the year and injured him in 1940 in Northern Ireland. My brother, who worked for Mrs. Thatcher, had been on a death list for 8 years. And I'd just spent a year in Washington trying to stop Gerry Adams get a visa. So I didn't feel warm and cuddly about them the first time I met them.
But how do you know that that is the way forward, speaking with your enemies? How did you have to learn that?
I didn't know. What happened was 3 days after that meeting, I got a call from Martin McGuinness. And he said, will you come to Northern Ireland? Come incognito. Don't tell the police. Don't tell the army. So I asked Tony Blair, he said, do that, don't tell anyone else. I flew over there, I stood on a street corner, feeling like a rather foolish guy in Derry, and two guys with shaved heads came and pushed me into the back of a cab. They drove me around for an hour till I was completely lost, and then they pushed me out of the door outside a little modern house, and I knocked on the door, and there was Martin McGuinness on crutches. And I spent 3 hours talking to him. We didn't make a breakthrough, but over the next 10 years, I would cross the Irish Channel once every week, every other week, sit with Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams in safe houses, and I realised by taking shares risks, by going onto their turf rather than demanding they come to iTurf, you can actually build enough trust to make a breakthrough in these things. If you just approach it as a diplomatic negotiation, if you just sit to informal meetings, you won't make any progress. You've got to build some trust first.
I gather that blindfolded and in the back of a car, you suspected you were on the right track, even though you might have been scared.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. You have to take a few risks if you're really going to make progress. Otherwise, nothing's going to happen.
Is that practical in dealing with Boko Haram? I mean, you can't send John Kerry over to Nigeria, can you, or do you?
You wouldn't want to send John Kerry. The point about these negotiations, and that's the interesting thing that's changed, is a sort of new diplomacy. These negotiations are actually done largely now by NGOs, by individuals who are prepared to take these risks. You don't want some big name to go there. You want someone who's prepared to take a risk, to sit with them, to open a channel. Even, I think, with ISIL in Syria and Iraq, if someone's prepared to go and open a channel, that can then lead to a negotiation over time.
Do you think a channel is open with ISIL?
I can't know, not being in government anymore, but I very much doubt one is. And I think this is the mistake we're making. With the IRA, we opened a channel in 1972 and didn't actually start the serious negotiations with them until 1998. So these things can take a very, very long time. But a channel is essential if you're going to open a negotiation.
In those years when nothing was happening, what was the value of the channel. How did you describe to yourself or claim to yourself that this had value?
No, the channel definitely had value. It negotiated a ceasefire in 1974. It negotiated the end of the first hunger strike in 1980. It served a series of purposes along the way. But had it not been there in that crucial period from 1991 to 93 with John Major, we would have never got into peace talks in Northern Ireland. Because in those circumstances, the armed group needs to know there's a political perspective if they put down their weapons, and we need to know they're going to put their weapons down so they can come into talks, and that's what it's about.
If ISIL is contacted by someone who claims to be a representative of the United States, how do you avoid the message that we agree you're going to have territory in Syria and Iraq, that the end game will be you being some kind of caliphate nation state that you can rally around some flag?
This is the mistake that people make. George W. Bush in 2004 made a speech to Knesset in which he said talking to terrorists was equivalent to appeasement. It was like Munich. It isn't that at all. Talking to terrorists is not agreeing with terrorists. When we sat down with the IRA, we were never going to agree to United Ireland at the barrel of a gun against the wishes of the majority of people in Northern Ireland. That was never going to be on the agenda. But when we sat down with them, there were a bunch of things they wanted to talk about. Power sharing, human rights, the Irish language. And it'll be the same with ISIL in due course. When we sit down with them, the first stage is to explore, to understand what they're about, and for them to understand how they're perceived in the world. If and when we get to a mutually hurting stalemate, when the two sides realise they can't win, then you could have a serious negotiation, but it wouldn't be about a caliphate. It would be about the grievances of the Sunnis in Iraq and in Syria who have been disenfranchised by sectarian governments in both Damascus and Baghdad.
Let's explore what you just said, a mutually hurting stalemate.
Yeah.
That's the key.
That is the key. And that's what, if you look back, and that's the point of my book, I look back over the conflicts over the last 30 years. And if you look at it, when negotiations succeed is when you have such a mutually hurting stalemate. Now, I'm the special envoy in Libya. When I went to Libya a year and a half ago, I thought, wow, we got a stalemate, we're going to make progress. But that's not the same thing. A military stalemate is not enough. They actually have to be hurting. They have to feel they can't make progress. They have to realize that they're not going to succeed militarily. And we saw that in Northern Ireland. What happened was in the late 1970s, early 1980s, the British Army realized that it could contain the IRA forever at a certain level of violence, but it could not destroy it. In the mid-1980s, Adams McGuinness, who joined the Republican movement young, realized that they too couldn't ever win. They were never going to drive the Brits out by military force. They were never going to be defeated, but they could never drive the Brits out. And that's when they reached out to John Hume, the Catholic leader, then to the Irish government, and eventually to the British government. And you see that repeated in El Salvador, in Indonesia, in the Philippines. That's when you have a chance of succeeding at a negotiation.
Was the peace or negotiation premature in Libya in the sense that while there may have been a stalemate that was hurting, you didn't have enough of a coherent government in Libya. And so once there was a successor to Gaddafi, it was kind of a Wild West show. Any militia had an equal chance to maybe take over. So they dissolved everything amongst themselves and hence the violence.
You're right. It was that there were a bunch of people who had guns. There are actually, interestingly, in Libya, no divisions of ethnicity or religion. Everyone's the same religion, the same ethnicity, broadly speaking. And the conflict is about power and money. And at that stage, they could still get some more empire money. What's interesting now is that they are now getting increasingly tired. You're seeing ceasefires breaking out because people no longer want to go on fighting. And there is some sign of success on the political track. But you need to be in that stage. You think about the Middle East peace process. In the case of the Middle East peace process, we do not have a mutually hurting stalemate. The wall, to that extent, has worked. It has stopped suicide bombing. So on one side, it is not hurting. So why would people talk?
And the Arab-Israeli conflict, do you think the principles from your book apply there, or has that just been going on way too long?
I do think they apply. I do believe after looking at the work I've done and after looking at the historical studies that are covered in this book, I do think that there is no such thing as an insoluble conflict. Everyone believed Northern Ireland was insoluble. Winston Churchill believed Northern Ireland was insoluble. Mrs. Thatcher believed it was insoluble. And a funny thing happens when you get to an agreement. You go suddenly from insoluble to inevitable. The next day, people say it's inevitable. It's because of economic circumstances. It was because of 9/11. Mm. But both are wrong, and it's important we understand both are wrong. No conflict is insoluble, and no conflict is inevitably going to be solved. It needs some leadership, it needs some patience, and an understanding of what's happened last time. Because there are always failures before you get to success. In Northern Ireland, we had four failures before we got to the Good Friday Agreement.
So the key ingredient is will of the parties.
Political leadership, I think, is what it's really about. I mean, if you think about South Africa, you had success in South Africa because you had two strong leaders. You had Nelson Mandela and you had F.W. de Klerk. And if you hadn't had both, it'd be very hard to get to that sort of agreement. Northern Ireland, we are lucky to have people like Adams and McGuinness ready to risk their lives to get to an agreement, but also lucky to have Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern on the government side, who stayed there for 10 years because often governments change. They were there for a long time and they showed real leadership and they were prepared to take risks.
Speaking of the risk of turnover in government, President Obama is on his way out. Do you see anyone statesmanlike enough to accomplish what you claim is possible in your book?
Yes, I do. I mean, there seem to be a very large number of candidates on one side and not very many candidates on the other side. So it's a bit imbalanced at the moment. Yes, I do. I think that without American presidential leadership, it's very hard to succeed in foreign affairs. The thing that I fear most is American disengagement. If America steps back from foreign policy, the rest of us are really lost.
Jonathan Powell is former chief of staff to Tony Blair and author of Terrorists at the Table, Why Negotiating is the Only Way to Peace. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.